So this is the first time I'm talking about this stuff, so if I'm a little clunky, please forgive me. So this talk is entitled Environmental Memory in a Model Microbe, and a little more tongue-in-cheek of microbes and memory. So a lot of people, you know, there are various definitions of intelligence, and one that I really like by a guy named Hawkins is that intelligence is the capacity to predict the future by analogy to the past. And so by this definition, memory is a prerequisite to intelligent functioning in the world. And though microbes, you know, are not generally thought of as possessing intelligence, associated traits like memory or learning, there are a bunch of reasons why one might expect memory in microbes in general and in B. subtilis, the bacteria we study in particular. So first off, so bacterial dynamics, they're, you know, these little watery bags of chemical reactions. And so they're kind of constrained by nonlinear physical and biochemical dynamical systems. That's what they are, they're dynamical systems. And so they must have at least some kind of very short-term transient memory, and they potentially could have longer-term memory. And the importance of this memory rests on like how far back in time they can remember, how long they keep their memories, what kinds of inputs they remember, and whether their capacity to remember is evolved and fitness enhancing or like some kind of artifactual and incidental. There are lots of systems within biology and within bacteria that are associated with memory. The most obvious being that whenever you look at an organism and you see, you know, what its genome looks like, its genome is in some ways a recorded history of the accident of a mutational process coinciding with the selective pressures that are brought to bear over the span of time. Bacterial chemotaxis, which was talked about yesterday, is an example of very short-term memory, right, where these bacteria, because they're not long enough to sample their gradient at the two ends of the cell, instead what they do is they sample in time and they remember the concentrations of chemoattractants or chemorepellents, and then they compare them over intervals of time to draw conclusions about the nature of the gradient. Phase variation mechanisms are another example of sort of intermediate memory. Maybe we should close that door. In bacteria, and what phase variation mechanisms are these. Sometimes they're genetic, sometimes they're epigenetic mechanisms in bacteria, and what they do is they cause sort of random variation of the expression of different traits in bacteria, such as in uropathic E. coli. There's E. coli that cause bladder infections. There are these little organelles that are expressed on the outside that allow them to attach to epithelial tissue and invade. It makes them virulent, and they kind of flip back and forth between expressing and not expressing, and so the probability of any cell in a population having expressing these organelles in some ways is it maintains a sort of a cross-generational history of the environmental conditions. And of course, in the immune system, we have, you know, cellular proliferation and survival, memory cells. And then maybe the structures that are, you know, familiar to everyone in this room, certainly, when we have, you know, switch-like feedback systems and regulatory networks, you know, through cascades, through you know, cooperative feedback, biphasic feedback, structures that in some way and cross inhibition, these structures can all lead to multi-stability, and a multi-stability is sort of inherently a memory-full system because the state of a system retains the memory of the last switching event. So one other reason why one might expect, just to summarize this last thing, there are one reason why one expects sex memory in bacteria, especially looking at this bottom line here, is that there are lots of structures within bacterial circuitry that are certainly suggestive of multistability, if not proven to be multistable, and therefore suggestive to be able to encode memory. Another reason why one might expect memory in bacteria is that you can make a pretty compelling fitness argument for why it would be useful for them to have evolved memory. So one possible view of bacterial phenotype control is from the perspective of game theory. And so if you look at bacterial behavior from the perspective as a game, then what you do is you're saying, okay, let's say that the players in this game are and the competitors are cell versus cell and cell versus nature. The moves of this game within for any cell are cell states or phenotypes. So, for example, like form a spore, express pili. This cell strategy can be looked at as given the input, possibly noisy input from the sensors, it's sort of a probabilistic trajectory through the state space defining their physiology, and evolutionarily stable, the behavior, whatever their behavior is, what they do when you put them in an environment could be viewed as an evolutionarily stable strategy, which just means that it's a way of behaving that's uninvadable by a rare mutant within the same moves. And if you look at it, bacterial behavior this way, within game theory, information creates advantage, and information about the past as well as the present creates even greater advantage. And it's well known that game strategies with memory are provably superior to those without memory. So one might expect that if bacteria are playing games and we know they're using information to control their phenotypes, why wouldn't they be using, they might be using information about the past as well as the information about the present in order to kind of chart their course, especially given that they have these structures inside of them that could potentially store memory.
In terms of winning the game,
yeah, winning the game is just surviving. Okay. It's just surviving, and so like a fitness function would be kind of like long term growth or probability of extinction, sort of minimizing probability of extinction. Okay, so now we can move on to B. subtilis, which is the bacterium that this project is studying. So B. subtilis is a gram-positive bacterium. It's this little, rod-shaped guy, grows in the dirt, non-pathogenic. So in the lab, B. subtilis grows very fast. It doubles on the order of every 20 minutes or so. But in its real life, out in the dirt, life is not so cushy because its environment is characterized by fluctuating nutrient levels and temperatures and osmotic stresses and salt and... And so it's developed some very, very cool strategies for surviving this harsh environment. So when under stress, so B. subtilis can form spores, which is it makes like a little time capsule of DNA. That's sort of it's like an inert capsule with a really tough shell that's very resistant to like high temperatures and radiation, and they can actually survive for like 1,000 years. These spores, and then if conditions improve, they can germinate and they can start to divide again. They can also become competent for DNA transformation, and what that is it's under certain conditions they make a pore, and then they actually like suck in DNA from their environment. And for either repairing their own DNA, for learning new tricks like lateral gene transfer, and possibly for food. There's some controversy over what they actually do this process for, but of course lateral gene transfer is the most fun interpretation, and there's mounting evidence for that. They can also make degradative enzymes and that allow them to eat things in the environment they wouldn't normally be able to eat. And I don't know if any of you use Tide. but the main ingredient in many laundry detergents instead of Tide, including Tide, is subtilizing, one of the degradative enzymes that B. subtilis makes. And if you go, there's this company called, I think it's Genencor, where they have these gigantic reactors, and they have these guys spewing out enzyme that then they sell. Yeah. And they can also, of course, chemotax. So they, when they're, you know, either threatened or there's not enough food, they can grow their flagella, and they can, you know, swim toward attractants away and away from repellents. Yeah?
What is it that subtilis keeps it protected from its own?
You know, I'm not sure. Because it's not, because I mean, like for the antibiotics, they have their own antidote. A protective antidote that's part of the regulatory network that makes the poison. So I think these enzymes, yes, you're saying like I don't know why it doesn't destroy them, but it's not part of, it doesn't seem to be part of the regulatory network that controls it. I don't know why it doesn't tear them up. Because you think, you know, laundry detergent, you should be killing some cells, but yeah. Anyways, and so in antibiotics, this is one of my favorite ones. B. subtilis makes, I don't know, like 10 or 12 or maybe even more antibiotics. And so it's got this whole arsenal where it's trying to kill off competitors in its own ecosystem. And some of the networks that control antibiotics are extremely cool and pose all kinds of conundrums. They also construct biofilms and have various alternative metabolic pathways. And so each of these little ovals here, they represent not just a stress response, but also a network of on the order of about 100 interacting molecules. And even though each one of these, you know, they're kind of studied separately, like they're little subgroups within the community that specialize in these different pathways, it's actually one big pathway because there's lots of cross connectivity and hierarchical control and feedback control. And so there's a ton of feedback inside of the networks that control the stress responses and between them. And this all this feedback, it sort of leads to, or I can't say it leads to, there is feedback. And it's also true that many of the phenotypes in that last diagram are under bistable control. And so, you know, you take a genetically identical population, you put them in the same conditions, and they don't all do the same thing. You know, you have, like, under some conditions, you have some cells that are forming spores and some cells that are not. And under other conditions, some cells that become competent and some cells that are not. And then you have this whole, like, sessile swarmer business of turning a switch on to see what state they're going to be in, whether they're swimming or whether they're forming these chains. And so, you know, this both the feedback in all these mechanisms and the fact that there's a lot of bistable control is very suggestive of memory, because a lot of the architectures look something like flip-flops, and they actually are achieving, a multi-stable control.
What is the reason for making these chains?
I don't know. I have no idea. It must have something to do with biofilm formation. I'm not sure. Okay, so that's one reason to expect it in B. subtilis, you know, sort of the architectures and the multi-stability. Another reason is that there seems to be a really obvious fitness incentive for memory in B. subtilis. And it has to do with the fact that these guys form spores, and that under really harsh conditions, that's what, like, a pretty high percentage of them will do. Sporulation takes a long time. It takes like 8 hours to form a spore. And there's some point in this process that's fairly early on where it becomes irreversible. So basically, if they've committed to forming a spore, even if the environment improves, so basically, you know, if to say that they start to starve, they decide to form a spore, they start forming a spore, if all of a sudden food becomes available to them, they can't just call it off and start growing. They have to go through the entire process, form their spore, and then germinate. And it takes a long time. And you could consider it a fitness defect. If they miscalculate, if they're starving and they go ahead and they commit to sporulation and then food comes, that it would induce a fitness defect because if they're over like a 10-hour period, they're not growing. And so if there are other cells that have a strategy where they waited, then they would be growing faster. And if you have a fluctuating environment, then overall the guys that waited would be more fit. And so here's just an example of the kind of environment where you would expect that memory would really provide a fitness advantage. And just say that you have something really simple where there are two possible food sources, and the environmental dynamics are characterized by alternations between periods of food and periods of starvation. You know, if one type of food source generally precedes a really long period of starvation and another type of food source generally precedes a short period of starvation, then if they can remember what they were eating before they were starving and use that memory to either delay sporulation, if food's going to be coming again soon, or sporulate quickly before they start dying off, if there's going to be a long period of starvation, you can imagine that would be very fitness enhancing. Yeah?
I'm being dense. What's an example of a food source, a third type of food source that's one comes out to another, the growth period, the growth period, the growth period?
You know, I'm not sure, but if you think about like life, like being in the dirt, and I don't know whether there's rhythms of rain and I don't know, weather related, or I'm not sure. I don't know, but I think because they're diversifiers, and diversification is like so strongly associated with temporal. With temporal variability in the availability of food. I mean, so I guess I don't know their natural environment well enough to answer that question, but I'd be really surprised if there wasn't a lot of fluctuation as part of their life cycle.
You refer to experiments here?
I'm going to get to experiments. Yes, this is just incentives. Okay, and here's something really cool. When I started writing this paper, which I'm almost done with, I found out that maybe you guys know what this is. I didn't even know it existed. There's such a thing as forensic microbiology. And so, like, for instance, after the anthrax attacks, there's this whole team of people that are busy trying to figure out whether by looking at the, you know, features of anthrax, they can figure out who sent it, where it came from. So it's forensics, just like any kind of, you know, investigative criminal forensics and any other subject. And so a bunch of research that got started right after 9/11 and right after the anthrax attacks, they were doing some work with B. subtilis and with anthracis. And what they found is that the spore coat composition, they use mass spec for this, depends on past growth conditions prior to starvation, which could be seen as a form of memory. And so that kind of adds to, so if you know about this forensics and you know about the architectures in B. subtilis and the bistability in B. subtilis and the possible fitness advantage of B. subtilis, it sort of makes sense for you to think, well, maybe there'd be memory earlier on in the process, at least in the sporulation process. Okay, so now that we've established kind of a general motivation, you know, why microbes might be expected to have memory, specific motivation, why B. subtilis in particular might have memory, and I'm just going to give you a hint that there might be something to this, but I'm not going to talk much about it, but we did some basically preliminary work that showed that there actually might be some memory, but I'm going to describe this later. But before I do that, I want to like back up a second and say, like, and which is what what we actually had to do after, because we ran some preliminary experiments, and we're like, wait a minute, what are we even talking about? What do we mean by memory in bacteria? How do you even quantify memory in bacteria? So now I just want to talk a little bit about a conceptual framework that we tried to put together to help us think about this, to give us a language, and to help us quantify it. And, you know, why do conceptual frameworks matter? Well, I think they matter because they define the scope of our questions. You get your questions from your framework, which then allows you to design your experiments and build your models, and there's this whole cycle, and you need language for that, and you need a world of objects to put in your imagination. And so I looked around, and I found some very cool papers, including Alexander's paper on enhancement of cellular memory by reducing stochastic transitions, which I would recommend to everyone. It's a very nice paper. These papers were not exactly what I was looking for, because I wanted like a clear conceptual framework. So the first place I went, given that, you know, I was trained as an engineer and did some dynamics once upon a time, and I guess I still do, I said, okay, well, dynamical systems, you know, it's a natural place to look. I thought, what does dynamical system theory have to say about memory? Maybe I can get some language from there, and I can get some tools for quantifying. And I went ahead and I looked around, and I didn't actually find that much that was like directly related, but I built a tree. So it's a pretty easy tree. So I thought, okay, well, from a memory perspective, you can say that a dynamical system is initial condition dependent in a Markov sense, or path dependent, non-Markov. And then within each of these, you could say there could be a transient initial condition dependent behavior, or there could be an asymptotic initial condition behavior. And then within each of these, they could be either stochastic or deterministic, like a reasonable tree of systems. So I thought, okay, so what is, so one kind of memory then would be deterministic transient memory. And what that would mean is you have a system and you're starting off in two different initial conditions. So basically past experience leads to different initial conditions. And eventually, if the cells are in the same environment, they'll act the same, but there'll be some period of time when they act different. And it could be that difference is somehow fitness enhancing. And here, I'm going to stop for a moment and say, you know, sort of natural question to ask is, wait a minute, all physical chemical dynamical systems have transients. Does that mean that all dynamical systems have transient memory? Wouldn't this reduce the classification to complete irrelevancy? And so I ask you to suspend judgment, because whether or not a transient could act as a short-term memory probably depends on the relative time scales of the selective forces acting and the length of the time of the transient. And so it could be fitness enhancing if you have a fluctuating environment and if your transient is sort of long enough to cover some part of the period where the environment is constant. And an example of that is there's a paper by Hoffer on alkaline phosphatase, and I'm calling it potentiation, though they didn't. But it was basically how a transient memory can provide a fitness utility to an organism. Okay, and then we have asymptotic memory, which is the kind that, you know, most people think about when they think about memory, and that's an example would be a bistable switch where your past history leads to different initial conditions, and your initial conditions lead to differences in behavior in the very, very, very long term, like infinite term. And you could say that's memory. Then if it's stochastic, then if it's transient stochastic memory, you're starting off with initial conditions, but this time they're distributions. And eventually the distributions may be converged to the same, but it might take a long time, or it might take long enough that it matters. It could be asymptotic and stochastic, so you start off with different distributions and you end up with distributions as far as anyone can look.
Give you the same distribution later on.
Well, some do, but at least in principle, you could have something that eventually that will always be different. Well, I mean, in principle, I mean, like, you can build a mathematical model that has more, you know, that has multiple stable, stochastic stable attractors, and indefinitely. I mean, you know, I don't know if there are physical systems out there that would behave that way forever, but certainly you can build a model, within one's conceptual universe as a possibility. Yeah.
Different or simple models. The branch data shouldn't be. The memory should be gone. If there's any noise, right? Yeah, noise will, at a certain point, just erase the memory.
Yeah, but if you have larger noise, it's just sooner.
Oh, I see what you mean. Maybe you're right. I don't know.
I see.
Oh, that's a good point. I'll think about that. I was imagining somehow that there could be that the same way that if you have a deterministic system, you could have two like attractors that are separated. I was imagining that you could have such a thing in stochastic, but maybe you're right. Maybe the very fact that there's any stochasticity at all means that there's some non-zero probability. Okay, you got me there. Okay, and then another possibility, though I don't know how like physically realistic this is, but at least in our conceptual universe, we can have this as one of the animals in the bestiary, is like a non-Markov stochastic memory where it doesn't just matter what your initial condition is, but it also matters like the path to your initial condition. And so someone can ask the question, what does the dynamical system view of memory ask about memory? Because if our whole purpose is to have conceptual frameworks, because it tells us what questions to ask. You can say, well, it allows you to ask, is the memory transient or asymptotic? What are the time scales? If it's asymptotic, how many attractors? What are their basins of attraction? You know, what's the map from input perturbation to separatrix? Is the memory just derived from initial condition dependent Markov dynamics, or is there some non-Markovian dependence, deterministic or stochastic? And if it's stochastic, is the stochasticity at the level of the individual cell only, or at the level of the culture? And so it's kind of going in this direction. And then Adam said, wait a minute. What about a Gödel machine? Which I had never heard of before. But Adam is great for knowing everything in the universe and coming up with some weird example that then launches you. And so a Gödel machine, it's an encryption schema. So basically, you can think of it as a box, and you're feeding it in an input string of numbers, and the box encodes this into an output string of numbers. And the encoding scheme is right here, and we don't need to get into it, but it involves a prime number and an exponentiation. And if you had no noise in this encoding scheme, you could take a single sample of this output and reconstruct the entire input sequence up to that. So it's in some sense an absolutely perfect memory, and yet like how does it fit into a dynamics framework at all? It's like, and so the question is. Well, it's a terrible encryption scheme, but conceptually it's an interesting one. And so then you say, well, what about information? If we're talking about memory, and of course memory is associated with intelligence, with brains, like how can we leave information out of our schema? And so we don't want to leave information out of our schema. And I'm just going to, I learned a little bit about information theory, enough to apply it, and I'll kind of give you a little, just two definitions basically, and here's my silly cartoon to illustrate what Claude Shannon was talking about. So imagine that there's some planet, and there's some man, and there's some woman, and they ask her, what are you thinking about? So the question is like, how much information could there be in her answer? According to Claude Shannon, information is a decrease in uncertainty about the identity of a symbol. And so, just say they live on a very odd planet where no one thinks about anything but pigs. So the answer has to be a pig because they don't think about anything else. And so then on this planet, whatever she's about to say will have no bits of information in it. Whereas if she lives on just a slightly more interesting planet where they think about pigs and frogs, then there'll be one bit of information in her answer because she might say pigs and she might say frogs, and you don't know in advance what that's going to be. A somewhat more interesting universe, we were adding a couple more animals, And in that case, we go up to 2 bits of information. Get that. And so here is his measure of information, informational entropy. And this is, just, to me, it's the most beautiful, brilliant idea. And so the idea is that information is the same thing. It's called entropy, and it's because you're about to communicate a symbol, and the more symbols there are, and the more probabilistically dispersed the space is over those symbols, the more informative that communication is going to be. So it's the probabilistic dispersion of a categorical variable. And that's entropy, informational entropy. Then another really important concept within information theory that I think is useful is the idea of mutual information. And what mutual information is just, and this is sort of developed in the context of a communication system where you have some channel and you have some signal space and you're sending information through this channel and there's a receiver here. So the idea of mutual information was developed to sort of address the question of if M is a signal sent and Y is a signal received, the mutual information quantifies how much information was actually transmitted. So it's the average reduction of uncertainty about a random variable X that can be obtained by observing the random variable Y. And so it's the entropy of M minus the entropy of M given Y. So if the signals are identical, then the mutual information is equal to the entropy of the signal. If they're completely independent of one another, then the mutual information is zero, because knowing one doesn't tell you anything about the other. So it's how much knowing one symbol will help you understand what the other symbol is going to be. Okay, so there's a precedent for using information theory to quantify memory, and my favorite paper on this, I don't think there's anything else like it, and it's just so creative, was one by Landauer. Anyone who's interested in this topic, I would really recommend getting his paper, which is How Much Do People Remember? Some Estimates on the Quantity of Learned Information in Long-Term Memory, and it was published in Cognitive Science, and he did something really cool. Before this paper, people had kind of put up, which is essentially a straw man, but they seemed to kind of believe it, which was saying something like, when they tried to estimate how much human memory there is, they would say, they would use the number of neural connections as an estimate for bit count. And then he had these really cool experiments where he showed people pairs of pictures and used, I won't describe the experiment, but basically he used information theory to design an experiment and then used information theory to analyze the experiment and came up with an estimate of 14 bits, which was way lower than the 25 bits or whatever that people had previously thought were in the human brain. So how do you adapt a communication metric to a memory metric? So you know how I have this picture here for sort of information theory for communications, where you have a channel and you have a signal sent and a signal received, and then you have mutual information between the received signal and the sent signal that tells you how much was transmitted. Well, you can turn this around a little bit and you can say, let this side kind of be the past experience. And let this side be future behavior. And so if you interpret Y as future behavior and M as past experience, the mutual information provides a measure of memory, because what it does is it says, if I know the behavior after T0, but I don't know the behavior before T0, how much does knowing the behavior after T0 reduce my uncertainty about what the cell experienced before T0. And so if there's some decrease in uncertainty about the past through observation of future behavior, then you can say the system has memory. And so now I'm just going to describe a type of memory experiment. So we call this an adaptive memory experiment for reasons I'll explain in a moment. And what this involves is, so you have, it could be one cell, it could be a population of cells. We get with a population of cells. And then we go ahead and we take them and we subject them to a bunch of different environments or treatments. So they have different past experiences up until the point T0. Then we stop them in their tracks and we remove them from the, whatever environment they were in, and we put them in a new common environment, which is a stress condition, but it's common, so that they're all experiencing the same thing from T0, and then we watch them. And we're calling this an adaptive memory experiment because it somewhat mimics environmental fluctuations that organisms actually have to adapt to, and to distinguish it from the more classical memory experiments in engineering that trace hysteretic loops, that look for hysteresis, that basically take some input and ramp it up and then ramp it back and look to see whether there's hysteresis, which then suggests memory, which is memory.
And there are two adaptations in this process, one which is the prior treatment and then your treatment at the zero?
You could say that. You could say that there are two. But I guess I was thinking of it more as there's a line, and there's everything that went before, and there's everything that went after. And we make sure that what goes after is the same, and what's before is different. And we look to see how the differences in their past experiences manifest in the future, in a future in which everything is the same.
Cells were in the same states.
Yeah. Oh, right. No. Yeah, so you think of it here, and then I should have drawn that, and then it branches out, and then it coalesces again.
They don't have any memory of your treatments.
Yes. Okay, so from an information point of view, you can say, so we want to ask the question, well, are we going to see, do we see any transient memory? And we say, well, we observe transient memory if observing, we have these 10 conditions, and now we have 10 responses, and we look at the transient portion of the response, and if observing this transient response leads to a reduction in our uncertainty about their past experiences, then we can say that there's some transient memory. Similarly, if when we observe the asymptotic behavior that leads to a reduction of uncertainty about where they were prior to T0, then we can say there's some kind of asymptotic memory. And here we're making an assumption that if an external partial observer, and I'll explain why I say partial in a moment, can detect memory in the organism, then the organism's behavior is modulated by the memory of its history, and it could potentially be exploited to confer fitness, though you don't know that until you do an experiment that actually tests for fitness. And so more formally, we define an adaptive memory experiment compendium, which is the set of all data collected from this type of experiment, and we view it as a measurement transformed sampling of a map from past history to future cellular response. We view the past history as a random variable, and it's going to have an associated entropy with it, which you can calculate based on how many different conditions you have and how many bioreplicates are put through each of the conditions. Asymptotic memory then is the mutual information between the asymptotic response and the cell history. Okay, now on to transient memory. Transient memory is a little bit harder to define, and there are a lot of options. And I'm going to show you what some of the options are and what we and how we chose what we chose. Okay, so there, because a transient behavior is a dynamic, and so you have many time points. You can. It's not like there's just one time point that you then calculate mutual information past, you know, past history, future. You have this whole range of time, and there are different ways of cutting it up and calculating with it. One way is to do something to do have a sliding window approach, and with that, what you do is you take some little window of response, and you have your past history vector, and you calculate the mutual information sliding it along, and that gives you a continuous measure of memory. Another way is a sliding interval endpoint, where you take, you know, transit response up to here, or up to here, or up to here, and so you just slide one end of it, and you calculate the mutual information. And the simplest way, and the way we ended up using, is instead just, you know, take the whole transient and calculate the mutual information between the transient and the history and do it for the asymptote too. And the reason we chose this one is because we feel like, one, it's simple, and two, I think it might capture better, the purpose of the memory, that because if what we're interested in is how many different qualitative classes of behavior are being produced in response to different past experiences, then taking the entire curves allows us to do that instead of a moment by moment calculation, which then you see you can have curves crossing and things, and so you get these funny like increases and decreases in memory, which provide their own form of information, but it's not quite what we were after. So we calculate transient memory as the mutual information between the whole transient and the history vector. And we add to that one more metric, which is memory fidelity, because all of these measures, asymptotic memory and transient memory, they give you results in bits. But the thing is that bits, you can't get any more bits out than you put in. So, the most you can possibly remember are all the things that within your experiment that you actually buried. So we wanted to get to normalize it. So this is just normalizing it. And so memory fidelity then is what percentage of past experience is remembered. So it's just a normalization. So
your memory space is simply the number of treatments, or?
Well, it's number of treatments and how it's. I mean, it's we treat it like a random variable. And so if we what you could do is you could actually have a random number generator with a bunch of treatments and then draw randomly from all your samples and make a real random space. We didn't do that. Instead, we just had three bioreplicates in each treatment, and so then that would be like a uniform distribution, and so then it ends up just being probability. It's pretty much straight, so it ends up not mattering. Okay, so these information metrics are useful in that they transform the lay questions, do cells remember past experiences and use these memories to modify future stress dynamics? And if so, is this memory short-term or long-term? And how much is there? Into well-defined queries about information and uncertainty that yield quantitative estimates of microbial memory in bits. There are some limitations, which themselves are very interesting, I think. And that is that, when you're experimenting on a cell, there's so much going on inside of a cell. There's so many variables. And whenever you do an experiment, you're choosing to measure, to observe only a very, very small subset of what's happening. And the fact that you are not observing everything means there are lots of unobservable states, and some of them might be important. And so, like, if you have, just say you have two variables, X and Y, in some system, and the only variable you're going to be looking at is X, then if you have a scenario like this, where you have three distinct initial conditions, but you can't see them in X, you can only see them in Y, then observing X might make this look like a non-Markov process, when in fact it's Markov. You can also have, you know, uncontrolled and unobserved inputs. You can have measurement errors and distortions. There are discretization artifacts. There are lots of different kinds of errors. We view those as fundamental. So basically, unobservable states, uncontrollable and unobservable inputs, and measurements errors are inherent in memory experiments, but they mostly result in underestimates of memory. And so we interpret our quantifications as lower bound estimates. Okay, so now applying the framework. Let's see. Oh, I still have some time. Good. Okay, so here we have our actual system and the experiments we did and our results. So what we looked at, so you've got some of these stress responses here. We chose to look at sporulation and degradative enzyme synthesis through APRE, and a third observable, which is an easy enough one to do, which is growth through optical density. And so what we did is we built a reporter strain where we have a fluorescent reporter, a GFP, which is green fluorescent protein that's attached to the promoter of a sporulation gene that turns on fairly early in the process but doesn't turn on otherwise. We attached a DS-RED, which is kind of a red glowy protein, to the promoter for APRE, which is degradative enzyme synthesis, and then we've got some antibiotic resistance, and we integrated it into the genome so there are no plasmid issues, multi-copy issues. So now here we have the experiment we actually ran, which is with 30 flasks and 10 different treatments. And our treatments, these are for the history, our treatments were growing them either in a medium called LB, Luria broth, which is this really rich medium, and it's got everything cells could possibly ever want to make them deliriously happy. And there's another one called GM, which is also a growth medium, but it is much more limited in its carbon sources. So we have these two media, and then so that was one difference within the 10. And then the other difference was the density to which we grew them in these media. So we grew them, we took them out of their media at this point T0 when they were still growing exponentially, but we grew them up either to like an OD of 1 to 0.8 all the way down to 0.1. So we grew them up to either a high density or like high, medium, or low density. So those are our 10 path conditions. The condition that we put them all in, the common condition, is a starvation media, which is the sporulation salt media. Yes. And oh, absolutely. This was almost random. This was almost random, and we have to follow up. Yes. It was an easy choice. It was an easy choice. Yes, we just picked from what people use. So going ahead and doing this calculation, there are 3.32 bits of information in the cell history space. So that means that at the very most, we should be able to read out 3.32 bits on the asymptotic signal and on the transient signal, and probably a lot less, and maybe none at all. Maybe none. So now I'm going to start with our sporulation reporter. And just quickly to give you the nuts and bolts of how we actually do the calculation, pretty simple. I'm sure there's a better way of doing this, but so we have our sort of experiments where our cell history comes in, our cell response comes out, and we have a big matrix of numbers, a bunch of time series. So we measured. These are mostly bulk experiments. So what we did is we put them in a sapphire TCAN fluorimeter. And we have them read every 15 minutes for, I mean, the experiments I'm going to show you are for 24 hours. We've done it up to like 48 hours. And then we take these measurements, all these time series, and we kind of divide them into an asymptotic and a transient response. Then we take our transient responses and we cluster them. I used Euclidean distances. I used two linkage functions. I used word linkage and I used average linkage. And then I applied silhouette criteria to all the linkage functions for pretty much all the sizes. And I picked, and so that way I picked the, I optimized, you know, by the criteria, the silhouette criteria, for the clustering, like the best clustering. From that point of view, then I used that cluster vector along with the cell history vector, and I calculated mutual information, and that gives me my transient memory estimate bits, and it's the same thing for asymptotic. That's the basic procedure. Okay, so here we have the sporulation response. So I've got my SPO2E reporter. This is starting at time T naught, and there's 30 different trajectories. And just from looking at it, you can see, well, I had 10 conditions. And I seem to be getting out more than one response and fewer than 10. So there's some kind of intermediate history dependence I'm seeing here. So first thing I did was I clustered the response. And it clustered into five different sort of qualitative classes. Well, I don't know if it's a problem. I mean, that could. So it's more like, what is the explanation? So I'll get to that at the end. I have a bunch of different scenarios. Some more exciting, some less exciting. Oh, they're error bars. The error bars are the bioreplicates. Okay. Yeah. So I have these like five different transient behaviors. And then I went ahead and calculated the mutual information. And what I got out was 1.96 bits of transient memory, which is the same thing as a fidelity of 0.59. And what that means is that if I look at the behavior, the transient behavior, observing the transient behavior reduces 59% of my uncertainty about the past. But then that kind of lumps the different aspects of cell history, because there are two aspects of cell history, right?
Sorry, could you repeat once again what you had on the ordinate here in the left panel?
Sorry, right. Okay, so this side here?
Yes.
Okay, so this is GFP. It's sort of like average GFP over the population. Oh. And the GFP is hooked up to a promoter.
So simply the fluorescence?
It's the fluorescence. It's the fluorescence, and the fluorescence is a measure of the activity of stage two promoters. Okay.
Did you do measurements before time zero just to check the initial conditions, how they differ for these 10 different conditions?
Or are all zero? We tracked the growth beforehand. Mm-hmm. And just to make sure they were still in exponential phase, and they weren't glowing, so they were. I mean, that's where partial observation comes in. Because clearly there's something different about them, but you couldn't read it off from our observables, because our observables don't turn on until starvation. Yes?
At t equal to zero, all the different systems are in the same condition, or the response of at t equal to zero are the same.
Yeah, and then they. This is T0 here, and so from T0 on, you start seeing some differences in their behavior, but from here on, they're all in the same conditions, they're all in the same media, they're all experiencing the same starvation media condition.
So just intuitively, okay. If I key to model a lot of candidates, but I can guess what the initial conditions are.
Uh-huh.
Initial treatment that had one chance in 10 of getting it right. That's your initial uncertainty.
Yes.
But by looking at the trend in, and then guessing what the pre-treatment I would have one chance in three of getting it right.
Well, two, about 0.59. Almost a little. You reduce 59% of the uncertainty. So you go from 1 in 10 to about 1 in 2.1 or something.
That's what if you can see the whole transient.
If you can see the whole transient.
You just look at the asymptotic response.
It's less.
More like there are three different.
It's less. More like. So.
You are doing the average for the population of bacteria, right?
And they're stochastic, and I'm ignoring all kinds of information. Absolutely.
Yeah, so you are actually reducing the information.
Yes. Yes.
It's possible to do it individual basis.
Absolutely. And actually, we have time-lapse microscopy gearing up, and we have a flow cytometer. We did some measurements on a flow cytometer, but we didn't do this analysis. The thing is, you can do this kind of analysis on anything. It's just like you have just signal out past experience. You get a better measurement if it's single cell, but you still get some information if it's on a population.
If you give, as you said at the very beginning, pulses, so before.
Yes. You give pulses?
Yes. Do they behave only the same way?
How do you give
if they see starvation before?
Well, we haven't done that yet. But that's one of the things to try, is instead of having it just be one past experience and then one future, to actually do some variability, vary them back and forth, and measure growth. And we have fitness. We're just starting up with fitness experiments, fitness and observations. So this is just the first pass on this, just to try it out.
Normalized by the growth rate.
Yeah. It's normalized by the growth rate. So there are two aspects of cell history, and the bit count before was just looking at each of these histories like from kind of a higher or as a lumped quantity. And so then you can ask, well, how well is medium remembered versus cell density in the that it was grown up to? And the medium is remembered very well, 100% fidelity. And the cell density is remembered less well. It's remembered with 80% fidelity when it's grown in LB, but not at all when it's grown in this other medium, GM, the nutrient-limited medium.
So may I ask you, I don't know anything about this, so little technical detail.
Yeah.
How do you change the from the LB or GM to starvation medium?
You take the flask and you spin down the cells and then you resuspend them.
So basically you assume that all the any remaining...
Oh, you wash it. You wash it. Yeah.
What's the difference between LB and GM again?
LB is a medium with like lots and lots of everything. It's like boiled cow, kind of, or boiled yeast.
Beef broth.
Huh?
Beef broth.
This is like yeast broth, but it's got everything in it that anyone would want that small. The other medium is more limited. It's limited in carbon sources. It's like casein hydroxylate is the main carbon source, and it doesn't have a bunch of free floating amino acids and simple sugars and.
And from LB, which one is the less dense? Which is the
least dense?
Least dense?
Minus 4 is the...
Oh, minus 4 is the least, yes. And it's,
okay.
So this is to an OD of about 0.1.
So when you resuspend it in starvation medium, then you equalize the density as
Yes,
well?
Of course. Absolutely. We didn't do that at first, and we were conflating things, and then we had to redo everything.
Okay, it's the first time. At least it's not well controlled in the above the good stuff, but there's also very small amounts of stuff, which are, and the more cells you have, the trace amounts, where it's ketamine, since you make everything yourself, there are only four components.
You know, LB is richer. LB is like GM plus stuff.
It's richer. I mean, since it's
My impression is that you can actually build LB almost like from GM, that it's like extra, like that there aren't a lot of things in GM that are not in LB. I'll get to like alternate explanations at the end, but maybe you're right. But I thought
using synthetic media, things would be better, makes more sense.
But neither one is totally synthetic. I mean, they're both synthetic, but neither one is totally. The thing is that the actual sporulation protocol is GM to SM, and after doing this, you can see why. Because that's how you get reproducible. I mean, so basically, what they had done was they engineered a media that got rid of all the history-dependent behavior. You know, so this is like, you look up at the protocol, this is it. It's interesting. Probably trial and error. And so then another question was, well, how much of the transient memory that we see is explained by the memory modulation of the sporulation delay? And the reason we asked this question is that you can, I mean, sort of like the explanation of before, why we'd expect to see memory in the first place is it seems like if they could remember, if there really is a connection between what they were eating before they started starving and how long they're likely to starve, that that like a smart strategy might be having long delays versus short delays, depending on what they were eating last. And so you would expect there to be if there's memory anywhere, and if it's significant, if it has a fitness effect, and if it's evolved, like you kind of expect it to be in the delay. And so went ahead and it took these curves and here's just a plot of delay as a function of the 10 different conditions. And what you see is that 85% of the transient memory is explained by the cell history modulation of the delay. So basically, if you take the calculate the mutual information between the delay and the past history, you get almost as much memory as you do when you look at the entire curve, which I thought was interesting. Just look to see. Once it trips itself, it was somewhat arbitrary, and you could have picked it. I mean, I picked like some percent over its baseline once it crossed that.
Correct that growth.
Oh yeah. Right. Yes, it's all corrected by growth rate. Okay, so here, this is a very cool picture, and what it represents is even cooler, I think. And so this is just some of the known quorum sensing machinery inside of B. subtilis. So, and what quorum sensing is it's the way bacteria supposedly communicate with one another. So there are certain things that bacteria do that they will only do when there are a lot of them. And a really great example of it is Vibrio fischeri? It's one of the Vibrios, and they live inside of a fish bladder, and they glow, and they only glow when they reach a certain high density. And there's some kind of a relationship between the bacteria and the fish, and something co-evolutionary that happened. But they have this little mechanism where they synthesize and excrete some little compound, and they also read it in a positive feedback loop. And what that means is that whatever is being controlled by this little network will only turn on if they're high density, and otherwise they won't. And that's why it's called quorum sensing. And B. subtilis has a ton of quorum sensing. And the common wisdom is that high density is necessary for sporulation, and that this control is affected by some part of this massive quorum sensing machinery. And one of the interesting things here is you get all these delays, and when you see delays, you immediately think, "Oh, quorum sensing is likely to be involved." But this is not quorum sensing in the traditional sense, because when we resuspended them in the sporulation media, they were all at the same density. So if there's anything going on here that has to do with quorum sensing, it has to have been before T0. So,
perhaps in simple interpretation, you mentioned positive feedback or autocatalysis,
yeah.
is that you delay is simply the induction period for the autocatalytic process.
Exactly, exactly. But what I'm saying is that that simple interpretation does not apply here.
Uh-huh.
And the reason it doesn't apply is because at time T naught, when we put them in starvation conditions, they're all at the same density. And so you're getting all these delays, but you're not getting massive differences in density, at least not initially.
Well, I'm not sure about this.
So it could be, I mean, it's not a simple story. It might be a quorum sensing story, but it's not a simple quorum sensing story. Okay, and then on to asymptotic. Once again, you know, asymptotic memory might be expected because you see this these sort of bistable looking distributions of on and off cells. And if you look at the network, this is kind of a mess looking, but basically what this is, if you look at the skeleton, is it's a cascade with a ton of feedback back onto this cascade. So, you know, cascades with feedback, you know, are very associated with multistability, and multistability is very associated with memory. And so you say, well, how much memory is in the asymptotic dynamics? And we clustered these. And I know this from this picture, it looks like this should be its own cluster, but it's less like that. It's actually, the algorithm is actually very conservative, so it clustered these into two different clusters. And that leads to little less than a bit of memory, and that is a memory fidelity of 0.265, which means that 26.5 of the uncertainty about cell history prior to T0 is reduced by knowledge of the bulk behavior in the long term.
So what happened to the right cluster in the
back? What? With this?
The middle one.
This thing here?
Yeah.
It gets counted as part of this one, partly because of the algorithm. And we ran a bunch of these, and we ran a lot of experiments. And I mean, my feeling about it is that the algorithm was right, that this really is more part of this behavior, and that and this only shows 24 hours for the time series we have that go to like 48 hours. This ends up being closer. So it's sort of, I mean, some of the clustering, I mean, even when you apply, you know, the most systematic methodological techniques for deciding what your correct clustering is, it's all a little biased in one way or another. I don't know if any of you have done clustering, but I use a conservative criteria, a conservative systematic criteria.
And GMs are going together in one cluster again, and already all these.
GMs and the lower density guys on the LBs are all together,
uh-huh.
And then you see, because these guys are, you've got these LB guys coming in here, and you've got some in the other one.
The red is the low density of them.
What was that?
The reds are low density.
Yeah. One of the lower density ones, not the lowest. So far we've shown that, you know, sporulation commitment dynamics exhibit both transient and asymptotic memory of cell history, that there's more transient memory than asymptotic, that past medium composition is remembered better than past cell density, that transient memory is mostly explained by history-dependent delay, which is likely to have an impact on fitness. Maybe I'm going to go through some of this quickly. There's something that I think is more interesting kind of toward the end. So maybe I'm just going to very quickly say, is it all right if I just go very quickly through the next two things and then we spend a little more time on the last? Okay, so this was just the second observable, which is ECRE synthesis, and I can quickly say that it shares a lot of common regulators with sporulation, but it's thought to not be multistable. So it's one of the reasons why we chose it, is that it has a difference in its control. But because it has shared, so it has some reasons that would, some things about it that would make you think it should have a similar memory characteristic from sporulation, which is that it has all these shared regulators. But then something different about it because the mode of control seems different, non-bistable. And what we saw is, you know, we have 1.4 bits of transient memory, 0.72 bits of asymptotic, and so it's less memory than sporulation, but not that far off. And there were some interesting differences that you could see when you looked at, like, the standard deviations within the clusters. You had a much bigger standard deviation for APRE, and you also had a greater correlation between past density, which we thought had something to do with the fact that, you know, the sporulation control is looks like it's bistable, and this is more more like a rheostat. And then there's, you know, growth dynamics, and you might say, well, why growth dynamics? I don't get very much into this in this or the paper, but I actually think this is one of the unsolved frontiers, is like growth control in stress conditions. I totally believe that, the work on the persisters. Are you familiar with that? There's some work done on persistence in E. coli that shows that E. coli, even when they're in like good conditions, like well-fed conditions, they seem to alternate. Some of the cells will alternate between a state in which they grow a lot and a state where they don't grow at all, and that helps them when they're subjected to antibiotics, because some antibiotics only kill cells that are growing. And I think that growing or not growing is like part of stress strategy, like universally. And it's certainly involved in sporulation and probably enzyme synthesis too. And just to quickly say, we see about 1 bit of memory. And something really curious, and I don't have an explanation for this, but what we see is that if you look at, these guys are all the GM guys, and these guys are the ones that were in LB. And the first thing that I thought was kind of weird is that GM guys grow a lot more than the LB guys, when the LB is supposed to be a richer medium, and you'd kind of think that maybe if they'd been well better fed before,
well,
they could.
In case of neurosporins I work with, the complete media, which is the richest media, is where they're sometimes being toxic.
But they grow, but when they're in the media, they're growing great. So it's not like it's toxic. I mean, they grow fabulously in the media. This is when they're not in the media anymore. It's just bizarre. So that's one thing. And the other thing is that the bigger, so if you look within the clusters, the bigger the density that it was grown to, the larger the density, like the slower the growth when it's in GM, but the faster the growth, it reverses itself.
Perhaps they want to be in that rich medium, don't go away from it. So.
Yes, that's one of the, and maybe if they're making a prediction that it's going to be good again, then they just kind of sit still.
But I also think that these are the guys who got the least shock. So they were closest to starvation.
That's true. That's one of the explanations too.
What starvation means is just salts?
It's just salt. There's like nothing to eat in there, or almost nothing.
How do they grow?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if they're eating each other or they're like stored something up.
This is a measure of
so how are they getting? How are they making more? And I don't know. I mean, there's a little bit of food, but there's something mysterious going on with the growth.
And the changing shape, can that affect OV?
Well, eventually they form spores, but that doesn't affect it that much. Yeah, it's mysterious. Okay, so far, so we've motivated the search for memory in microbes and presented information theoretic way of measuring memory. Have some of these observations. And then there's an obvious question, which is what I wanted to get to. It's like, so that was looking at the three signals independently. What happens when you start looking at them together? And so this is, sort of to me, this, I'll just show you kind of what my chain of reasoning was. And some of this is suggestive of questions I didn't answer, so I apologize for that. But so sort of like there's a question of, if you think about like an object that lives in a particular space, like just say vehicles. You know, vehicles all live in three-dimensional space. But one of the questions that like physicists ask about any kind of a physical system is they say, what dimension does it really live in? You know, you don't believe that it necessarily lives and behaves in the dimension that it would most that it most superficially seems to live in. And an example is just like a if you think about a train. A train's a three-dimensional object, but it maneuvers pretty much in one dimension because it stays on a track. And a car, once again, three-dimensional object, but it maneuvers in 2D because it stays on the road. And a helicopter, that's a three-dimensional object that actually maneuvers in three dimensions, right? So here's the question, my question train. So the first one is, how do you think about what is the state space that defines a cell? Because like within a cell, you have thousands of molecules, and like which of them are important, and what dimension, what is the real dimension of behavior within your cell? And then that leads to, we have these three observables. What dimension is the information in those three observables? And then, of course, there's the question of, if we're seeing memory, what dimension does the memory occupy? And so then you ask, is there more information in the higher dimensional space of the combined observables than in the individual ones? And then finally, is there more memory embedded in the higher dimensional space of combined observables than in the individual? So this is sort of, so it's this last question that I answer, and I do not have any idea about the other things. So what we did is we looked at the, instead of looking at the signals individually, we looked at the pairs, SPO-APRE, SPO-OD, APRE-OD, and we looked at the triple. And we wanted to know, is there, how much memory is found in the vector space, these vector spaces. And so I did a little reading, and I found a very useful inequality. Actually, I sort of derived this one first. This is nice, and then I found it, and then I believed it. And this inequality is that the entropy of a vector pair is less than or equal to the sum of the entropies of the two variables, and is greater than or equal to the greater of the two entropies. And that translates into, when you're looking at memory, it's memory in any pair has to be greater than or equal to memory of the most retentive signal, and less than or equal to the sum of the memories. And then when you think about what control schemas might come up, might produce both the maximum and the minimum, you can say, well, if the two pathways are in completely independent control within the experimental conditions that you're testing, then you expect the maximum. And if your pathways are controlled by a common signal, you expect the minimum. So then I just use this to define memory orthogonality, which is just a normalization, so that when I'm looking at a pair or a triple, if I hit the minimum, it's a zero. If I hit the maximum, it's a one. And so then we ask the question for transient memory. Is there more memory in the higher dimensional space than in the individual spaces that you look at, if you look at them independently? And the answer is no, strangely enough. And here's just an example where if you look at SPO2E alone, you have these five classes of behavior that correspond to the conditions listed, and that's 1.96 bits. And if you look at APRE, you get three classes of behavior at 1.48 bits. But if you notice, the boundaries overlap. And what that means is that when you combine them, you don't get any more information out than the most retentive pathway. And that was true for all the pairs and for the triple. That was surprising to me. But with the asymptotic memory, we asked the same question and we got a different answer. And here's just to show you. So, if you look at sporulation alone, you get these two classes. So you can distinguish these conditions from these conditions. You look at APRE, you also get two classes, but the boundary is different. You can distinguish these conditions from these conditions, same thing for OD, get a different boundary. When you put them all together, you end up being able to distinguish four different classes of histories, and that gives you more bits. And so you could say that it occupies a relatively high or a higher dimensional space. And then we also checked mutual information, and this is just, maybe I'll skip this, it's not that interesting. And here's just a little picture, which I kind of like, even though it might be a little confusing. That summarizes the measures, and so it just shows, here we have our cell interacting with our environment, and here's our observer, and here's our measurements, and we have OD, APRE, and SPO2E, and we have cell history here, and these little shapes here represent mutual information, and these little shapes here, which are maybe represent vectorizing something, and then this just shows where blue is transient, red is asymptotic, and it just shows the percent memory fidelity of growth, APRE, sporulation, and then each pair, possible pair, and then the triple, and then this shows the mutual information between the signals. Okay, so now ending. You'll be glad. This is taking a long time. So if we did find evidence that bacterial cells are able to remember their histories and use these memories to alter their behaviors in a fitness-enhancing manner, this would bring them closer to that Hawkins definition of intelligent beings and enrich a certain view I'm partial of Motif's modules and games view of bacterial regulation by adding game strategies with memory to the mix. And so here we showed, you know, we developed a conceptual information framework for memory. We showed B cells remembers in the short and long term aspects of its cell history, and that different cellular systems remember different aspects to different degrees, and this leads to the ability to combinatorially store information, at least asymptotically. We did not show that it's fitness enhancing and evolved. We haven't even speculated over what the molecular mechanism is, but we see it as this work as a first step in what could be a larger memory program that, you know, either we might do some of, or maybe other people will get interested, who knows. And so there are sort of three questions here, basic questions: the what, the how, and the why of bacterial memory or any other kind of cellular memory. So one way to extend this work is to, you know, do what you were asking and suggesting, which is, you know, look at it at the single cell level to kind of parse out whether the memory is stochastic, deterministic, and of what sort if it's stochastic. To look at other cellular players instead of just those three. To experiment with different kinds of cell histories to try to get a sense of a larger space, and maybe try to map it more onto what they actually see when they're in their home environment, and to look across, you know, to see whether memory manifests differently among different strains of Sutilus, and among different species that have the same phenotypes but have very different niches. Then the how, of course, to look at causal mechanisms. You look at a network like this with all this feedback, and you say, well, you know, if there is memory, is it in here? Where? What features of the circuitry are responsible for memory? Is it within one of the little networks that people define as going along with each of the stress responses, or is it a property of some like larger, like Uber network or Meta network? And then there is a question that I find really interesting, which is like, is the memory in individual cells? Is it in populations? Or is it something that lives in the larger space of the cell environment, you know, like with biofilms and all the things that they make and the quorum signals? And then, you know, why? Is memory controlled or incidental? Is it advantageous, disadvantageous, or neutral? And is there evidence that memory does not provide a fitness advantage in the present, but rather in a future that's implicitly anticipated from past experience? Are they anticipating the future somehow? And we don't know the answers, but here are some speculations, not about the what, but about the why. And so this is just showing I've extracted just a couple of curves. Okay, so here we have blue guys are the ones with a history of growth in the poor nutrient environment, and red guys are the ones with a history in the rich nutrients. So this is LB, this is CM, and I'm just showing growth and sporulation. And you can see that they're, you could almost look at this as two different types of behavior, two different strategies maybe, if it's in fact a strategy and not just an artifact. And you can say, well, the ones grown in a poorer nutrient environment, they seem to grow and sporulate pretty much immediately, whereas the ones grown in initially grown in a rich nutrient environment have sort of a wait and see behavior. So they don't do much of anything for a long time, then they start to sporulate and they grow a little, not as much. And so one possibility, the more exciting possibility, which might or might not be true, is that this is evidence, or not evidence, but this is a product of a game strategy with memory. And so what that would be is part of their strategy is that they're predicting how long starvation is going to last. And if when they last ate something really delicious, they assume that more food's coming soon, so they stop and wait. Whereas when they last ate something that was not so tasty, they assume that starvation could really last a while because life is tough. So that would be a game strategy with memory. Or it could be that the guys that were grown in a poor medium or a rich medium, they wait because they can. And the guys that were in a poor medium, wait, so we have rich to starvation. I'm sorry, I'm totally mixed up here. Poor to starvation, wait because they can. Oh.
It's like poor and rich.
I do. Okay. So one category waits because they can, and the other acts because it's okay. So it's wait because they can, and the other guys act because they must. And finally, there was the suggestion that I think Alexander made, which is that this is all just about adaptation and metabolism, and the guys that are going from, I mixed it up again, rich to starvation grow immediately because they must, oh gosh, I'm completely confused here. But anyways, a product of adaptation. And these explanations, however confusingly they were posed, if I could straighten them out, are, I think, not mutually exclusive. And fitness experiments coupled to a game analysis will be necessary to distinguish among the possibilities. And this is just, I did a little bit of analysis a while back. This is just showing a hierarchy based on a really simple model. This is just for sporulation. So if it's sporulation is a game, this is a, you know, basically deterministic starvation triggered is like the least advantageous. Diversification, if they can diversify, they do better. If they can use quorum signal or environmental memory in the diversification, they do even better. And when they can combine it, you know, they do best of all. And each one of these strategies is a, what I'm hoping to do, or see someone else do if I don't do it, is connect together these sort of game analysis with like information and control. And so that's what this is just showing my an attempt that it just started. And so each strategy requires a different type of information. You either need, you know, information about environmental state, nutritional cell state, memory density, or memory environmental density. And you can see each one requires different combinations. And each type of control requires different types of, or each type of strategy requires different elements of control. And so, you know, some require an internal model of environmental dynamics. Others require estimators of cell state, predictors of future. And so there's a way of, like, building all this up and then having your network, your dynamic network analysis. And I mean, it would be beautiful if it could all come together and have all the experiments to go with it, but I don't know if we'll get there. Well, I'm done, and I hope I offered food for thought and convinced you that memory and cellular behaviors is maybe perhaps an interesting area for future exploration. And I want to thank Lisa Fontaine-Baudin, who's a postdoc who did a lot of the experiments. Adam Arkin is my co-PI and mentor and friend, and we have sort of team subtlists, and Jay Kiesling is also a co-PI, and we are funded by NIH.